Thank you very much, Rav Shapiro. It's a real schuss for me to be here today. First of all, has Zachary ever sat in this seat before? Had that feeling. It's a schuss to be here. 31 years ago, I was a Talmud here in Shalavim. As Rav Shapiro and I were just speaking, I had the immense schuss. Rav Yamer was my Rebbe. I think he was a third-year Rebbe at the time, if I'm not mistaken. Rav Waxman, then not known yet as Rav Waxman, was our Madrich. Rav Chaim Cohen was Shana Aleph with me. He wasn't Rav Chaim Cohen at the time, nor was he Chaim Cohen. Rav Reich was Shana Bet. Rav Noam Konigsberg was Shana Gimel. So it really brings back a lot of great memories to be here today. And I had this chus in recent years to speak in a few different venues. Had the opportunity to speak in YU about 4 or 5 years ago to Rav Moshe Tzvi's Beis Medrash program, about 70 guys. And a few years after that at some of the local high schools in the New York, New Jersey area. So to be able to fill that in with an opportunity to speak to you guys here in Shalvim is a real kavod for me. So thank you very much. Let me start with a question. The question's a simple one, and I would suggest a foundational one. Why are we in the world? Why are we here? So yesterday, I borrowed Zachary for a day from his learning, and we had the opportunity to travel and visit many incredible Kivrei Tzaddikim up north. And one of the places we made a visit to, I try very hard every single time I'm in Israel not to leave Israel without visiting the kever of the Ramchal. Why the Ramchal? That's a long story for another day. I have to stop at 7:30, I'm told. If I spoke only about the Ramchal, I'd go till 9:30 or 10:30. But I personally, my neshama, I feel a real kesher with the Ramchal. The Ramchal's one of the pillars. You can actually argue in the last 300 years, you can make an argument that the Ramchal had as big an impact on Jewish thought and machshava as anyone. You certainly can make that argument. And the Ramchal's Sfarim had a very big impact on my life. And every time I come to Eretz Yisrael, I try very hard to go there. But the Ramchal's magnum opus, we all are very familiar with it, probably his most famous work, is Mesilas Yesharim. And if you open up Mesilas Yesharim in the very beginning, and right now, by the way, I'm immersed in Derech Hashem. I see a lot of guys have it in their makom here. I think Derech Hashem is like the secret of the entire world. I highly recommend it. But if you open up Mesilas Yesharim, right in the very beginning, the Ramchal gets right to it. Ma chovaso ba'olamo. I think it's on the very first page. Ma chovaso ba'olamo. What is man's... It's very interesting when you look at the English translation. What is man's obligation in the world? What is man's obligation in the world? You know, I've seen a lot of commentary about that question. Because at least in America today, I don't know about in Israel, in America, everybody feels very entitled. The question is always, what are my rights? And the Ramchal is saying, not what are my rights, which really means not what is owed to me, ma chova so, what is my chova in the world? What's my obligation in the world? So I mentioned earlier that I've spoken in a couple of high schools in recent years, and a Rebbe once said to me something very interesting that I've thought about. I'm sure you guys come from numerous different high schools. Most high schools, if not every high school, probably has a college guidance department, right? Most high schools, I would hope every high school, has an Israel guidance department. It's always interesting, and don't say this out loud, if you think back about your own high school, what department really was like the ikker, right? Some high schools... Let's be real, college guidance, that was the department. All right, there's a little bit of an Israel guidance department too, but what was the ikker, what was the tuffle? Maybe in some high schools it was the other way around. But here's my question, I'm not knocking high schools, here's my question. Where is the machovaso ba'olamo department? Like before we have to figure out where we're going to college, before we have to even think about maybe Yeshiva and Eretz Yisrael, do we spend time thinking about why I'm even in the world in the first place? Rav Hillel Paracher was one of the earliest Chabad Hasidim. Now, I've had a few guys ask me here over the last few days. I guess word's gotten around. I'm a very big Talmud. I'm not a big Talmud. Let me say it differently. I'm a very dedicated Talmud of Rav Moshe Weinberger. And the following story is a mushel that he's told. I heard him say this many years ago. If you're going to listen, let me give you a hint. I learned this from Rav Weinberg. He doesn't say this, but I learned it from listening to him. If you're going to listen to anything here in the next few minutes, please listen to this mushel I'm about to share, sort of my opening mushel, and maybe the closing mushel. If you want to space out in between when I talk about my story a little bit, you're welcome to. But if you remember this mushel I'm about to share and the one at the end, I think you'll walk away with something. So this is a mushel Rav Weinberg shared a number of years ago, and I think about this literally all the time. It's a mushel originally told by Rav Hillel Parcher, one of the original Chabad Hasidim from probably a couple hundred years ago. And this mushel it's the story of the lost niggun, the search for the lost niggun. And here's how it goes. Imagine a couple hundred years ago, in a small shtetl in Eastern Europe, we'll say Poland somewhere, you have a Jew, you can imagine such a scenario, you have a Jew who's very poor, who has so many worries in life, has so many tsaras, and one day somebody comes to town and sings him this tune, sings him this niggun, that for those 3 or 4 minutes while he's listening to this niggun, it just connects with his neshama so deeply that for those 3 or 4 minutes he completely loses himself. He forgets about all his daigas, he forgets about all his worries and all his challenges, and his neshama feels like a certain uplifting. The next day, you know, this is 200 years ago, right? There's no recordings. There's no iPhones recording. The next day he says to himself, you know, for those 3 or 4 minutes, I literally went to another place when I heard that niggun. I have to hear it again. And he starts trying to remember it in his mind, and he can't quite recall that niggun. He starts going around to all his friends. He says, you know, I heard this unbelievable tune, maybe you could sing it for me. And they don't know what he's talking about. So this one sings this niggun, that one, another friend sings a different one. It's not it. The days go by, the weeks go by. The more time goes by that he can't recall this niggun, this tune that he heard, he becomes more and more obsessed with needing to find it. And he starts traveling from town to town. And he starts traveling all over Europe from one Baal Menagin to another, from one professional singer to another. And each time he goes and tries to describe this niggun, maybe you could sing it to me. Every now and then he hears a certain like a chord or a note, and he briefly, momentarily says, you know, that might be it. And then he realizes, nah, it's not it. It sounded for a second like it might be it. It's not it. And this is the mushel of the search for the lost niggun. The obvious nimshel to this story is famous medrash where we're told that before we're born, right, a malach comes, we're taught in the womb, we're taught kol haTorah kula. Right? You guys have heard that before, right? We're taught kol haTorah kula. And right before we're born, we get a little tap on the lip, and we forget everything. And the neshama goes into a guf, and descends into this physical world. And let me tell you guys something. That neshama, I'm telling you as somebody who's out of yeshiva, in the work world for 30 years, that neshama spends a lifetime in search of that lost niggun. We know once upon a time we heard something that took us to a place that's like we can't find it in this world. And what do? We spend a lifetime traveling from one Baal Menagin to another, one professional singer to another. For some of us, that Baal Menagin might be the Yankees, it might be the Mets, it might be the greatest vacation we ever went on, it might be the greatest, newest iPhone we went on that we've ever had. Whatever it is, fill in the blank. These are all Bali Nagina that we're running to in search of that lost niggun. We're searching for meaning. We're searching for happiness. And every now and then, by the way, I'm a big sports guy. I actually coached basketball at MTA for 16 years in a previous life. Won a few championships. Still a sports fan to this day, I can't lie. But at the end of the day, it's nothing but another Bali Menagin we're running to in search of that lost niggun. And every now and then, our team wins a championship. Maybe the other night, nobody from Kansas City here, right? Nah. So maybe our team won the Super Bowl. Maybe our team had a big game. You know, and for a brief moment, we might have felt like a momentary simcha and thought like, oh, maybe that's the niggun. But at the end of the day, our neshama knows that's not the niggun, right? Rav Dov Ber Penson once said, and I love the way he worded this, the more we try to feed our spiritual hunger with material trappings, the emptier we feel. And this is very true in life. So let me transition for a minute and tell you a little bit about my own story. I'll preface it by saying it's not a unique story. I think it's a story that many, many people of my age, of my generation, experience and go through each in different ways. And perhaps by hearing a few of these things, it might leave one or two of you with something to think about. I come from a frum background, an amazing background. I had one grandfather who was nifter at the age of 101, a Holocaust survivor, lost 3 children in the Holocaust, lost his parents, his siblings, rebuilt his life in America. That's a whole other story. And he woke up every day till he was 101 at 4 o'clock in the morning to learn, 2-3 hours every day before he went off to work. He literally knew Shas Bal Peh. He did this till he was 101 years old. That was my hero. I had another grandfather who never went to yeshiva, never had the chance to learn growing up, raised a frum family in upstate New York where it was unheard of in those years. At age 80, retired, and in retirement decided to pick up a Gemara for the first time in his life, took on Daf Yomi at age 80. He spent approximately 10 hours a day on the Daf because he wasn't just going to do it. He was going to understand it. He would try to listen to Shurim. He would try to learn it. He would call my cousin. He would not go to sleep until he understood the Daf. At age 88, he made his first Siyum HaShas. He was nifter at age 90. So I do come from that kind of background. I grew up on the Upper West Side. I went to MTA. As I said earlier, I came to Shalvim, unbelievable yeshiva, went to YU. And then let me explain to you what happened. It's what happens to so many people. And perhaps from hearing a little bit of this today, it'll be on your radar screen to formulate a good game plan, not just for when you're in yeshiva, but most importantly for when you leave yeshiva down the road. You know, you leave Eretz Yisrael, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it's going to be. You go off to wherever you're going to go from here, whether it's college or whatever you're going to do. And then you enter like the next tikkuf of your life, right? The next stage of your life. And that stage of your life very often becomes dominated by what career am I going to go into? What do I want to do with my life? How am I going to make a parnasa? When am I going to start dating? Who am I going to marry? What kind of family? These are all the thoughts that a few years from now will start, you know, sort of dominating the thought process. And then you go out into the work world. And as you proceed to each of these, you know, levels in life or stages in life, especially when you enter the workforce, you're now exposed to all sorts of other elements and different things. In my case, I've worked in a family business for almost 30 years. I oversee the sales department, numerous salespeople, thousands of what we call sales brokers. Not as much travel since COVID, but prior to COVID, literally every week. Zachary can attest, you know, 2-3 days a week I was in a different state. I could be in Chicago one day, in Dallas the next day, Atlanta the next day, home for Shabbos, running all over the world. And in my case, at least, I can say, if you don't firmly have your feet planted on the ground, if you don't really have a plan how to remain fully connected to what really matters in life, it's like being on a little rowboat in the middle of a big ocean. If you're not rowing very, very hard, that ocean starts to pull you away. I guess the better mushroom would be, you know, famous thing, if you're like trying to climb an escalator that's going down and you're trying to go up, you have to work really, really hard to keep climbing. Because if you stop working hard, you're just going to drop back. And that was the story with me, to be totally honest, if I'm going to be honest about it. You know, years go by, and all of a sudden, the learning I thought I was doing was less and less, until I was really not even opening up a safer anymore. Then before you knew it, I woke up one day and was drifting and really wasn't going to Minyan. I became a little bit of what I call like a once-a-week Jew. Okay, I'm from Teaneck, which is a pretty nice community. I don't know, everyone's from different places. But there are a lot of those once-a-week Jews in Teaneck. The few guys from Teaneck I see here, your dads are not in this category. But there are some once-a-week Jews, right? The once-a-week Jews are those guys who show up in shul once a week. They'll come Shabbos morning, maybe Friday night if they're really feeling inspired. From Sunday to Thursday or Friday, forget about it. There's like no chance. Some of those guys, will like every shul has that minion, right? That, you know, that minion that the goal is get me out of here in an hour and 10 minutes. If it's an hour and 12 minutes, like I'll shoot somebody. If the rabbi speaks 2 minutes too long, that's a disaster. If the Baal Kori goes 3 minutes over, that's a bigger disaster. Those are the once a week Jews, right? I was sort of becoming a once a week Jew, I would say. Really kind of doing the minimum. When Rob Waxman asked me to share some thoughts the other day, he asked me on the spot, so what's your topic? He gave me 2 seconds to answer if I'd speak and another 3 seconds to give him a topic. So the topic I gave him was listening to the knocks from above. So let me share the following. Every person, I believe, in life, especially as you get older, you're going to hear the knocks. Somebody who's not as connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as davuk with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as one should be, guess what? Hashem's going to come knocking. Sometimes Hashem comes knocking often. Hopefully he doesn't come knocking in a hurtful way, right? Chas V'Shalom want that in life. But Hashem comes knocking at your door if you're in a situation in life where you're drifting. Now, some people in life, especially as you get older, maybe they're not really listening. Maybe they refuse to listen. Maybe they're ignoring those knocks at the door. For many years, I ignored those knocks. I was very zocha in my life that I reached a point in life where something happened and I started to listen to those knocks. Listening to the knocks from above. Let me share just a few of those knocks that I experienced. I could tell you many such things. And to be honest, I believe these knocks come throughout life. It's an ongoing process. I'll just share a few things. All these things I'm about to share all happened within about a 3 to 6 month period. I would say about 11, 12 years ago. Okay. Knock number one. Happened with Zachary's oldest brother, who attended Shalvim just a few years ago. And we were at a family barbecue in upstate New York. A few hundred extended family. And we had rented these ATVs, okay? And I remember I was busy talking to a few people. And all of a sudden, you can hear off in the distance, about a half a mile away, quarter mile away, an ATV was flying down this dirt road in the direction where we all were. And I wasn't paying much attention. And all of a sudden, we heard like a loud explosion. And it's amazing because, you know, each and every one of us in this room, we have unbelievable kochos that we don't know we have until the moment, chas v'shalom, where we have to use those kochos. You know, it's like if you needed to practically lift up a car, it would sound like the most impossible thing to do. But if chas v'shalom, like, lo aleinu, a relative of yours was under that car, you could pretty much almost lift that car. Like the koch you have when you need it is unbelievable. I was standing there and I knew in the back of my head that my oldest son, Jonathan, and my youngest brother were on that ATV. I heard it flying down the road. We heard a loud crash. I was not very fast on the basketball court when I played, but in about literally 5 or 6 seconds, I made it the 100 yards to where he was. It was an unbelievable miracle. So thankful that despite the fact that he was a little bloodied, very scratched up from head to toe, neither my son nor my brother had any real injuries, but they were going 50 miles an hour on an ATV and crashed. Knock number one. Got my attention a little bit. After many years of success and mazel in business, you know, here's another very interesting thing. A lot of people in life, myself included, we really get very high on ourselves. We think we have talents, we have abilities, we're smart. We go to college, we major in things, and our hatzlacha, our success in life, in business and other things, it's all because of us, right? I was very bright. I mean, I did this, I did that, it's all because of me. I'm not going to say it doesn't have anything to do with you, and don't get the wrong message. Everybody, you have to do your shtadlus in life. You have to work hard. But if you think it comes from you, and it's only you, big mistake. So here we are having hatzlacha, business growing over several decades. All of a sudden, about 11, 12 years ago, everything that could go happen, that could go wrong in the business world, and particularly with our business, everything, series of events, story for another day, everything happened all at once. And literally overnight, from great mazel to like being on the brink of bankruptcy. Overnight. I mean, complete nightmare. Hashem's knocking on the door. I remember at that time, I probably had not opened up a safer. I'm going to be honest. I had not opened up a safer in numerous years. Maybe to study with one of my kids for a Gemara test a little bit, but years had gone by, drifted, not learning, not going to Minyan. And a group of my friends were learning, and one Friday night they made a Siyum. I wasn't learning with them, but I said, great, a Siyum in the neighborhood. Why not? My friends, I'll go to the Siyum. And Rabbi Przanski, the former rabbi of B'nai Ashurin, comes to the Siyum. He had no idea what I was experiencing in my life, all these challenges at the same time. And he tells over something that, like, completely pierced my soul. It was as if, with the 50 guys in the room, it was as if he was speaking directly to me, and he had no idea what was going on with me. All right, Pazansky quoted a Gemara, and I believe the Gemara is in Sanhedrin. And the gist of the Gemara is that Hashem basically comes knocking on your door. Hashem will send messages for those who are not connected. And there's different levels. First he starts here, then he goes there if you don't listen, and then he goes to your mammon, financial. And then the Gemara says, then he comes, chas v'shalom, for your health. I remember sitting there thinking, okay, this happened to me, that happened to me, the next level, my mammon, next comes health. Woke me up a little bit, right? And then one more thing happened. This just blew me away. I was traveling, as I said earlier, every day, a few days a week, all over the country, all over the United States. And for a period of about 6 months, there was this one book in every single airport I went to. Every bookstore in every airport, I would see this book, like, prominently displayed, almost as if it was waiting for me to buy the book. The book was called Proof of Heaven by Dr. Eben Alexander. And I would constantly see this book, and I looked at it maybe once for a second. The author is not even Jewish. You know, some sort of, you know, experience where this guy is going to talk about proof of heaven, but he's not Jewish, so what does it mean to me? I'm not getting the book. It's not for me. One Shabbos, I come to shul. Again, another, it's funny, right? Pazansky again. And he gets up in front of hundreds of people. And he says, one of the congregants gave me this book, and he proceeds to speak about it in his Shabbos drush, and it's called Proof of Heaven by Dr. Eben Alexander. My antenna goes up a little bit. Let me quickly share the story of Dr. Eben Alexander. It's an incredible story. Dr. Eben Alexander was a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon, brain surgeon, top of his field, not Jewish, living in North Carolina, extremely wealthy, in his 40s, slim, healthy, you know, mansion, four cars, six dogs, 1.7 kids, you know, typical American average, right? But top of his field. And he was a self-proclaimed atheist. He was convinced there is no God because he was a person who felt, as a lot of these people are, if you can't show that 2 plus 2 equals 4, then I don't believe it equals 4, right? These rational people sometimes are sort of missing the boat. So what happened to him? One day, and this is a true story, one day he woke up, perfect health, and he wasn't feeling well. An hour later, he really wasn't feeling well. An hour later, he was in a coma, lying in a hospital, and they had no idea. They couldn't figure out what happened to him. And this Dr. Eben Alexander went into such a deep coma for the next week. The doctors, all the specialists, told his family he has almost no chance to survive. And if he does survive, he's going to be a vegetable. He's going to be brain dead for the rest of his life. A week goes by. His family is praying for him. He's not Jewish, right? His family is praying for him, trying to beseech heaven, so to speak. And all of a sudden, a miracle happened. After about a week, he starts to wake up. A week later, it's as if nothing ever happened. And literally a month or two later, he's back to performing brain surgeries like nothing ever happened. Dr. Eben Alexander claims that when he was in this coma for a week, he remembers his entire experience. It's one of these near-death experiences. And he describes in his book in tremendous detail. He saw this incredible light. He saw like a joy he never experienced before. He found out when he was in his coma that he had a sister that died when he was a child, that, or when he was a baby, that he never knew about, because he met this sister when he was in a coma, like in his dream. Now, is this story completely true, partially true? I don't know. He claims it is, but that's not what got me. What got me is right. Pazansky is telling over this story in shul. Goes on to say that there is a Gemara that describes what happens when a person leaves this world. Both a Jewish person, obviously, one thing, a non-Jewish person also something different. But the Gemara explains what it is. And he says, all I can tell you is the Gemara says exactly, describes what this doctor says in the book happened to him. Now we hear that story. By the way, this is all happening like in the same period of time. I'm starting to hear knocks. I'm interpreting all these things. My son's ATV accident, business troubles, all these different things, the story with this doctor. I feel like these can't be coincidences. I'm getting all these messages. I'm drifting. I'm not connected. I'm starting to hear these knocks. And then the total game changer. If you guys have 22 minutes to spare, 22 minutes. There used to be a news program when I was growing up. We didn't have internet or computers. You'd had the radio, you had TV. There was a radio station like a news station. I remember their tagline used to be, "You give us 22 minutes and we'll give you the world." Like, in 22 minutes, we'll tell you everything going on in the world. If you guys have 22 minutes, I would listen to Rabbi Sacher Franz's speech at the 2012 Sima Shas. His speech at the last Sima Shas was excellent. His speech at the 2012 Sima Shas single-handedly changed my entire life. So my father, Zachary's grandfather, also very inspiring later in life. He's now learning, but for many years he wasn't learning either. But he really loved to go to the Sima Shas every 7.5 years. Never did the daf, never learned it himself, but he would go to the Sima Shas and I would go with him. And so I went. This is 2012. I'm in the heart of everything going on, all these knocks. But my friend gets up there, and I'll give you the gist of what he said. I won't do it justice. You've got to watch it. Watch it again and again. It's unbelievable motivation. And Rabbi Franz's message that day at MetLife Stadium, 90,000 people there on an August night. Stadium was quiet as can be. What an unbelievable speaker. And Rabbi Franz said the following: anything we want to accomplish in life that has value, you need to have a plan. If you want to go get a piece of pizza, you don't really need a plan. You can just go get a piece of pizza, right? If you're going to build a house, you need blueprints. If you're going to start a business, you need a business plan. If something has value to you, if you want to think about where am I going to be in 5 years and 10 years, how am I going to grow and learn and stay learning like you are now in 5 or 10 years, you've got to have a plan. And Rabbi Franz said the following. He said, there's a Gemara that speaks about the fact that every person, every single day of his or her life, has a bas kol in the back of our minds that's basically whispering us to us, saying, what are you doing to have a kesher with a Kadosh Baruch Hu? What are you doing to fulfill your chova in this world? And some of us might be hearing that bas kol, some of us might not, but at some point in life you're going to hear that bas kol. And we eventually wake up, whether it's at 30 years old, 50 years old, 90 years old, we have to answer that bas kol at some point in time. So here's what Rabbi Franz said. If we're going to take that seriously, we need to have a plan. So he says, here's the plan. He's screaming with great drama in front of 90,000 people. And he says, tomorrow morning, Daf Beis of Brachos, brand new cycle of Daf Yomi. And everyone was quiet. And he screams out, and if you can't do Daf Yomi, Amud Yomi. And he pauses. And if you can't do Amud Yomi, Mishnah Berurah Yomi. And if you can't do Mishnah Berurah Yomi, a Mishnah a day. And then he screams out the line that, I'm telling you, this line changed my entire life. And he screams out, something a day. And the stadium was like, shit, something a day. I remember thinking to myself at that moment, here I am, disconnected, drifting, getting all these knocks and messages from Hashem. I'm trying to understand why I have very little relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he just gave me the answer. I'm doing nothing a day. What relationship in this world, whether it's with people or anything else, am I going to grow or gain when one side is doing nothing? You want to grow a relationship, each side has to put in some effort. I'm doing nothing a day, and I have very little kesher with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So here's what happened. I decide, August 2012, I'm going to start listening to the knocks from above. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to start Daf Beis and Brachos. Now, in full disclosure, it was probably the third or fourth cycle that I said that about, but I did feel a certain sense of, like, this time's going to be different. And I remember I learned brachos. Daf Yud, Daf Yud Aleph, I keep going. I was doing it myself with an art scroll. And I remember finishing brachos, the unbelievable sense of accomplishment. Hadn't opened up a Gemara in I don't know how many years. I finished Maseches Brachos. Me and a bunch of guys from Teaneck, we made a big deal out of this. It was like a Super Bowl. I remember the feeling, I'm telling you, like coaching MTA, as I said earlier, like making a Siyum on Maseches Brachos after not opening up a Gemara in so many years, 10 championships could not come close to that feeling. And we made a big deal about this. But here's what happened next. Then comes Maseches Shabbos. So brachos is very impressive. Shabbos is a little harder. Erevin starts to separate the men from the boys, and you keep going, and like the boys kind of fall by the wayside. So here I am in the middle of Masechta Shabbos, and Zachary's oldest brother, this is probably around 2013, his bar mitzvah comes. And all of a sudden, I'm busy with bar mitzvah plans. I'm running here, running there. One day I wake up, and by the way, I was only responsible to myself. I was learning Daf Yomi by myself. All of a sudden, I wake up one day and say, oh my gosh, what's going on with my Daf Yomi? I haven't done Daf Yomi in about 10 days. By the way, Daf Yomi is very interesting because it waits for nobody. It doesn't stop when you're making a simcha. Doesn't stop, lo aleinu, when there's a tragedy. Doesn't stop because you want to watch the ball game that night. It keeps moving, like the train keeps going, right? So I say to myself, wow, okay, I'm in trouble. Next 6 months, I made a rookie mistake. I like to listen to Rav Eli Stefanski. I don't know if anyone's heard of him. He has an amazing thought, which I really do appreciate. And he says, it's not about the daf, it's about the yomi. What does he mean by that? He says, the biggest yetzer hara when you learn daf yomi is you start to miss a few blot. And you're done. Like so many people just quit daf yomi. I missed 5, I missed 10, I'm done. I'm out. I'll learn something else. They never do learn something else and they're done. Right? He says, like you miss a few. All right, put it aside, write down what you missed. Learn today's daf. You have time later, you want to go back, that's fine, right? So I made this rookie mistake. I missed all these daf. And for the next 6 months, I'm like trying to catch up. I'm on, I'm off. I'm learning here, I'm not learning there. Finally, like it's funny how a Kaddish Baruch Hu does things in life. I'm telling you, when you look back on it, you see how the pieces all fit together. And I remember being at my niece's bat mitzvah in Florida. And what did I do? I decided I'm done with daf yomi. So what did I do? I have an uncle from Baltimore who's a massive Talmid Chacham. He's been teaching daf yomi. He's been a Magid Shir in daf yomi for decades. He's a massively successful lawyer. Like, he's got it all going on. And what do? I go over to my uncle at my niece's bat mitzvah, and I speak to him for a minute. I say, I'm out. Daf yomi, I'm out. I'm done. I fell off the wagon. I quit. Like, if I really wanted to quit daf yomi, that would probably be the last person I want to go to. I probably could have thought of 30 relatives to go to first who probably would have said, yeah, cool, right? But I go to my uncle, like, there's no way he's going to accept this. He sat me down. He goes, you're not quitting. You made a commitment, but you're doing it all wrong. Some people maybe can learn on their own. You can't. So you need to find a daf yomi shir. This was like 2012. It's amazing how time flies. In 2012, there was like only a couple of daf yomi shirim online. It wasn't a big thing. Like today, you have all these shirim online. You didn't have that back then. You find a daf yomi shir. Put it in your calendar like it's a business meeting, and every day you go. All right, so here's what happened. I think my wife might listen to the recording here, and Zachary might report back. So I got to give her a little credit for this. So I do the following. I'm a big shot. I look around Teaneck in those days, all these daf yomi opportunities, but I'm coaching at night and I'm traveling. I can't do this at night. Like, night's just not going to happen. So I decide I'm going to be a big shot. And don't forget, I was not going to Minyan in the morning in those days, right? There was a 5:30 daf yomi shir in B'nai Shurin. It's the earliest shir in Teaneck. I'm going to go to the 5:30 shir. Like, I'm not going, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go big, right? I'm going to do 5:30 in the morning. I don't know in those days, like, when I last saw 5:30 other than making an early morning flight for some business trip. 5:30 in the morning. The funny thing is, about 2 weeks later, I'm talking about this 5:30 in the morning daf yomi, and my wife says to me, you know what? All you talk about is this 5:30 daf yomi, but you haven't gone once yet. You keep talking about how you're going to go. So she said, I'll tell you what, I really don't care if you don't go, but if you don't go tomorrow morning, I don't want to ever hear about it again. Don't go, I don't care, but don't ever talk about it again. Now it's a challenge, right? So I went the next morning. I still remember the person sitting next to me, older gentleman, big Talmid Chacham. He said to me the following. He says, you know, it's not a usual thing that at 5:30 in the morning, somebody happens to be strolling by, sees, oh, the lights are on. Let me go. Maybe I'll. So you came here consciously today. Are you going to do this every day? I still remember thinking, telling him, you know what? I came today. I hope to come tomorrow. I don't know about 2 days from now, but I hope to come tomorrow. Next thing I know, like a few weeks go by. It's becoming easier. Becomes a few months, and this is what happens next. So the shir ends at 6:30. There's a 6:30 minyan. early on in that Daf Yomi journey, I start saying, you know what, I'm already here at 6:30 in the morning. What am I going to go home and not go to Shacharis? I may as well stay for Shacharis, right? So I start going to Shacharis every day. Then I start seeing, like, guys my age. It's a funny thing. You could have these once-a-week Jews, when lo aleinu, they have to say Kaddish, they become an Avil, Chas v'Shalom. It's unbelievable how they'll transform their lives overnight after not being a minion in years, and they won't miss a minion for the next year. You ever notice that? Like, a guy has to say Kaddish, God forbid, and all of a sudden that guy will, like, arrange his trips around where he can get a minion. It becomes like the center of your whole life. One thing leads to another. I start saying, why should I, God forbid, wait one day till I'm in that position? I may as well start going to Mincha Marav every day. I may as well, next thing I'm learning with this Chavrusa, I'm learning with that Chavrusa, this Chabura, somebody connects me to Rav Moshe Weinberger, forget it, now it's done, right? It was like one thing leads to another. And then I start realizing something. When you're searching for that lost niggun in life, when you start drifting, when you're 10 years out of yeshiva, when you're 20 years out of yeshiva, you start to realize something. That's the niggun I've been searching for all these years. Why did this physical thing or this materialistic thing, not saying you shouldn't pursue things in life, if they're kosher, that's fine, but just understanding, like, is that really the niggun? Or is that, like, it's dimionos, it's illusions. Could be fun. I love watching a good, you know, they're terrible usually, but a good Giants game or, you know, Met game. At least we have an owner spending money now. But it's not the niggun in life, right? Yismach lev mevakshe Hashem. Real happiness in life is being a mevakesh. By the way, I'm just a rookie. 12 years later, I think I'm starting to finish on Aleph. I'm like starting Shana Bet now in my life. But when you become somebody who wants to be a mevakesh in life, you start to sense what real happiness is. Let me share something that's unbelievable. Seeking Hashem, seeking Kirvas Hashem. I'll leave it to Zachary to tell you guys all the stories because I'm watching the clock here. But there is a massive, massive tzaddik who my family and I are very fortunate to have a real kesher to. Rav Yisrael Meir Druck Shlita, also known as the Eish Tamid. I see a few people here in their makom have his farm. We're very, very lucky that we have real kesher with him. Zachary and I went to see him Sunday night in Yerushalayim. He's a Rosh Yeshiva of 7 yeshivas with a total of 7,000 Talmidim. He was Rav Chaim Kanievsky's closest Chavrusa and Talmud for 32 years. I'll just put this little teaser out there. Rav Chaim said before he was Nifter that when he leaves this world, Rav Druk is the address to go to because his brachas are Mekuyim. And Zachary can tell you another time, we've seen unbelievable things with him. Anyway, we had this chus about 2 months ago. Zachary didn't because he's here, but he has a bigger chus. And we had the chance to spend Shabbos with him. I've been going to meet with him for 6 years to ask for eitzos, ask for advice. But 2 months ago, me and my wife and my other kids had the chance for the first time to spend the Shabbos with him. Whole story. I'll tell you the story really quick. About a year ago, a couple from Chicago, there may be people from Chicago, and I don't know the person's name. A couple from Chicago went to see Rav Druk and cried to him that they had a daughter. And over the course of many years, they had 11 or 12 miscarriages. And they needed a bracha. They needed an eitza. He gave them a bracha. He said, you're going to have a boy. And in approximately 1 year, I'll come to Chicago and I'll be the sandik. So 2 months ago, it was 9 months later, they had a boy. He went to Chicago to be the sandik. And he was in America already, so on his way back to Eretz Yisrael, we had the chance to spend Shabbos with him. And on Shabbos, he spoke in the shul, my brother's shul in Riverdale, and he said the following in shul. He said he wanted to teach us what the yesod, what the secret to tefillah is. And he said every time he's used this secret, by the way, here's something else I would take out of this. The mashal in the beginning, the mashal in the end, and take this out, what I'm about to say. The yesod to tefillah. He said it, he only speaks Hebrew. He said every time he uses this yesod, his tefillahs are answered, in his words, miyad. Miyad means like, they're answered now. Now, I'm not in his madriga. I don't know if I use this yesod if my tefillahs will be answered miyad, but that's a separate issue. And he says, what's the secret to tefillah? We all know the famous pasuk, we say it every day in Ashrei, from Tehillim, Karav Hashem l'chol karav. Hashem gets close to anyone who calls out to him. L'chol asher yikru'u, to anyone who calls him, and what's the last word? Be'emes. L'chol asher yikru'u be'emes. Now, he said, That's fine, but let me explain to you what be'emes means. What does it mean to call to Hashem be'emes? Like really be'emes, right? Rav Druk told us a story, and I won't say in public what the specific ma'isa is, but I'll just say that many, many, many years ago, Rav Druk did something for a family, and mamish like brought a nace to their family. It's an unbelievable story, like really an unbelievable story. And the person, the father of this child who he did this, let's call it a nace for, the father says to Rav Druk, this is many, many years ago, he says, Rav, the next time you're in L.A., this person lives in L.A., the next time you're in L.A., and he's a pretty wealthy person, I don't even know who it is, next time you're in L.A., please stop by. I want to personally give you a very significant check. I made a business deal. You saved my family. Rav Druk says, you know, he was a young Rosh Yeshiva at the time. His yeshiva really needed the money. He didn't want to tell this Kavir that him and his Gabbai literally got on the plane, Motzei Shabbos from Israel, flew to L.A., only going to be there one day, go to this person's house, get this check, fly back. He says he'll never forget. He walks into this person's house, and the person starts crying. Rav, I'm so terribly sorry. I thought I was getting this money. Now, the money's not coming for another 6 months. I feel terrible. I can't. Rav Druk said he was so broken. He went straight to shul in L.A. to Davar Mincha. And he remembers turning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his tefillos and saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ain't old Movado. You're the only one. I have no other answers. I thought I knew how I was getting this money. I thought I had all the answers. I realize I don't. I know not. You're the only one. Ain't old Movado. Please send me for the yeshiva, whatever, any way you want to send it. He said the minute davening was over, his phone, he got a phone call from this Gavir, Rav, please come back to my house. He went back to his house. I feel terrible. I really can't give you that amount of money, but I can give you a nice check even now. I really should have, let me give you a very nice check. And Rav Druk said the following. He realized at that moment that he had a whole cheshbon in his mind where the money was coming from. But as soon as he turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Eino Mavado, I have no idea how this money is coming to me. Only you know. It turns out the money really was coming through him. But now it's coming because he understood be'emes that it was Hashem orchestrating this. So his point was, in life, you have to do your shtadlis. If a person goes to daven, you worked on a business deal, you have something in your life that's really important, you had it, you worked it all out, and you turn to Hashem, please help me, let this be successful, that's not quite be'emes. Do your shtadlis, do your business deal. But when you turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, put that aside in your mind, send it to me any way, Hashem. You're the only one. It might come through that business deal. It might come through somewhere else. That's famous. I'm watching the clock. Let me tell you a couple more things. Let me tell you about my friend Jim Robinson. Jim Robinson is an Irish Catholic. He's a salesperson who I've worked with over the years. And a number of years ago, I'm driving with him one day in upstate near Syracuse, New York, on a business trip. And I'm telling Jim Robinson about my daily schedule. I'm telling him how at 5:30 in the morning I go to my synagogue. Wow, that's pretty early. I'm part of a study group. He's asking me about this. He's like, with great respect, I like Jim Robinson, great guy, but I didn't know if I needed to be talking to him about Daf Yomi and Minyan and all this type of stuff. And he keeps asking me. So I said, you really want to know? Yes. So here's what I said to him. Jim, let's think about life for a minute, right? What is life all about? For the first X number of years in your life, you're going to school. You're working so hard. Why? Because you want to get into the best high school you can get into. You break your head in high school. Why? Maybe you want to get into a great yeshiva, but for my story anyway, you want to get into a great college, right? In American society, right? Break my head. There's crazy stories. People are paying like tens of thousands of dollars to these, I don't know, high school entrance coaches to help them get into Ivy League school. It's Narsh guy. Anyway, so we got to get into the best college. And then in college, we got to break our head. We got to break our head. Why? Because we got to get the best job. Why do I need the best job? So I make the most money. Why do I need to make the most money? So I can send my kids to school and start the whole circle all over again. When you really think about it, you'll drive yourself crazy. Like I said to him, I didn't use the word tachlis, but like, what's the tachlis of life? Like this rat race. Where's the end game? Like, what's it all about? And Jim's like, yeah, okay, I got it. Like, there must be a higher purpose to life. My favorite story, Zachary's going to laugh. Haven't spoken to him in a while. He called me out of the blue yesterday. Haven't returned his call yet. I probably should have because he said he had a great story for me. Friend's name is Adam Meyerson. Maybe some of the TNEC guys will remember him from about 5 years ago. Remember Adam Meyerson lived in went to B'nai Ashurim, big muscular weightlifting guy, worked on security, right? You didn't want to mess with him. Here's the story of Adam Meyerson. This is an amazing story. True story. Adam Meyerson grew up way out in Long Island. For those of you who know Long Island, I'm not talking about the five towns. I'm not talking about any Jewish area. We're talking about like the far, you know, boonies of Long Island where there's no Jews. And Adam Meyerson knew he's Jewish, but he knew nothing about what it means to be a Jew. And he graduates college, and he's part of a chevra of guys that are all making money, all very successful. And he tells me the following story. One day I'm sitting in a restaurant with all my friends, and the conversation is around who is buying the latest and greatest Porsche and Lamborghini and sports car. And he said, in the middle of this conversation, his mind starts drifting, and he sees a banana sitting on the table. You guys know where I'm going with this story? He sees a banana sitting on the table. And he says to himself, I don't know why. I start spacing out about the conversation with the sports cars, and I'm analyzing this banana. And I say to myself, wait a second. This device, this unit, this banana has like a peel, has like a covering on it, and it's green. When it's green, it's telling me it's not ripe and I can't eat it yet. On its own, after a period of time, that banana turns yellow. Now it's telling me it's ripe, I can eat it. And I peel away the peel, the cover. On the inside is this food, it tastes great, nutritious. And he starts analyzing this banana, and he says to himself, as he's hearing all the talk in the back about the sports cars, there's no possible way that there isn't a creator with intelligence who created that banana. It's impossible. And at that moment, he realized he is missing the entire purpose of life. Adam Meyerson went on to become one of the most inspired Balei Tshuvas I've ever met. He got married. It's a whole story. Moved to Teaneck. He had a period of a few years. He now lives in Florida. He would sit in the base medrash of B'nai Ashurim and beg guys to learn with him. He would come to my house. I gave him Derech Hashem. I'm done with this. What do I read next? I'd give him everything with the English. Unbelievable story. Think about it. The intelligence, the planning, the purpose. Let me just rapid fire give you a few more things here in the next 3 or 4 minutes. The human eyeball. Let's talk about the human eyeball for 1 second, okay? And there's millions of examples of this. Let's just take the human eyeball. The human eyeball, I'm not an expert, but I looked this up. The human eyeball is composed of over 2 million working parts and over 1 million nerve fibers connecting each eye to the brain. You know, in the history of the world, with all modern medicine, the human eyeball has never been recreated. The human brain and memory. The brain is powered by a trillion nerves. Studies show that after viewing over 2,500 images for only 3 seconds, a person can recall with over 92% accuracy having seen that image. Unbelievable. Try the following. Take a deck of 52 cards. Randomly throw it on the floor. Record the exact sequence that those 52 cards land in. Okay? Record it. Mix the cards and spend the rest of your life throwing those cards on the floor trying to recreate the exact sequence of 52 cards. The mathematical probability of recreating the sequence of 52 cards is in the trillions. Let's just say it's impossible. If we can't recreate the sequence of 52 cards, can a human being create a human eyeball, a brain, a body? The unbelievable chachma, the unbelievable intelligence. Let me tell you about Sir Isaac Newton. You ever hear that name, Sir Isaac Newton? Sir Isaac Newton was a famous scientist that lived in the 1700s. He was not Jewish, but I understand he was a believer in God. And one day he invited one of his atheist scientist friends over to his house. He brings him into his study and he says, I want to show you something that's absolutely amazing. And he shows him this model that he had of the universe, all the planets with the sun, with the moon and everything moving around. It's a model that he had. And the scientist says to him, Sir Isaac, this is unbelievable. How did you create this? He says, I didn't create it. He says, where'd you get it? He says, let me tell you the story. One day, there was a dog chasing a cat. They ran through a junkyard of all these metal spare parts. And as they were ruffling through the junkyard, all these spare parts like shot up into the air. And they landed in this exact sequence. And now I have this model universe. And his friend says, Sir Isaac, that is so impossible. This thing is brilliant. You had to create it. Someone created it. And you know the punchline. He turned to his atheist friend. You think this model was so brilliant that it had to have a creator? And what about the world? I'm just going to jump to the end here, and I'll tell you one last thing, and I'll end with one last muscle. And my opinion is, when we're searching for the lost niggin in life, when we're listening to those knocks from above, you know, sometimes that when we're kids growing up, and certainly adults, we'll open up the Chumash, we'll read the Parsha, we'll read the Psukim, and we look at these as stories that happened like 3, 4, 5,000 years ago. What does this have to do with my life? How does this help me get the job I need? How is it going to help me pay the bills? You know, the brilliance of Torah, though, as you guys know, and I'm such a chutz for me to be here just for a couple days and learn with a few of Zachary's chavrusas and watch you guys and sit it on shir. And I was never as plugged into my learning in my Shalvim days as you guys are. Kol kavod to all you guys. But at the end of the day, the brilliance of Torah is, it's mamish like layers and layers and layers of MS. Like, you could just keep peeling back those layers until you find that layer that's nogea to your life. I happen to be someone who likes learning Nesiva Shalom. It gives me some inspiration. And the whole derech of Nesiva Shalom is that Torah is nitzchias. Everything in Torah is forever and applies to our life today. Let me give you one example. In another, month or two, it's going to be Pesach. I love this thought from the Nesiva Shalom. Vayar Yisrael seyada gdola asher asa Hashem b'Mitzrayim, vayiru ames Hashem, vayaminu b'Hashem uv Moshe Avdo. Right? I'm not going to translate. You guys all get it. We say it every morning in davening. Famous question many ask. I thought that the fact that Klal Yisrael had emuna Mitzrayim was one of the reasons we got taken out of Mitzrayim. So why is it only now by Kriyas Yamsuf that Bnei Yisrael vayaminu believed and saw, and all of a sudden they had emunah, right? Nesiva Shalom often talks about a person that has three levels of emunah. He calls it emunas hamoach, intellectual emunah, emunas halev, and emunas hayvarim. I guarantee everyone in this room has complete and full emunas hamoach. We all know intellectually a Kadosh Baruch Hu exists and runs the world. And many of you, and I probably don't, but many of you probably do, might have emunas halev, where it starts to really become part of your heart and part of what you do. But how many of us, maybe some of you do, I don't, how many of us have emunas ha'ivarim? It's like we live with it in our kishkas, right? People who smoke, I don't know, when I was growing up, I never smoked. But people, like my parents' generation, everyone smoked. No, I don't think a lot of people smoke as much nowadays. But how many smokers, is there a smoker out there who would say it's healthy to smoke? Everyone intellectually knows it's not healthy to smoke, right? But how many people like live with that in their kishkas? How many people live with this emunah, live with this Torah? Let me end. I'll conclude with one last story. We'll get you out of here right at 7:30. I don't know. Is the food that good here that you're running to dinner? It is. It isn't. All right. We're working on it, right? Let me end with the following story. I started with a Rav Moshe Weinberger mashal. I'm going to end with a Rav Moshe Weinberger mashal. I heard this recently, and I keep thinking about this. It had a really impact on me. Imagine we're going back to that Eastern European shtetl, right? We started with the guy searching for the lost niggin. Let's go back to the shtetl. Now our friend Rav Yid is a very artistic guy. He loves his family, loves his wife and kids, but something's missing in his life. The first guy was the niggin. This guy, he's missing. He's a great painter. He's missing that perfect masterpiece. And one day he leaves a note. He writes a note for his wife on the table, on the kitchen table. Tells his wife how much he loves her, how much he loves his kids. He says, I'm really, really sorry. I am in desperate search of the perfect masterpiece. I can't find it. I have to go travel for a while, but I promise you I will return. I love you. I love the kids. Please just give me a few weeks, a few months. I will be back. And he leaves in the middle of the night. He starts traveling the countryside for days at a time, eventually gets tired, sits down at the side of a tree at the edge of a forest, and he hears some commotion. He looks into the forest, and he sees this beautiful scene of a chasen and kala, like a beautiful chuppah. And he's watching this, he's observing it. He says, wow, I've never seen such ahava in my life. This is like real ahava. He takes out his canvas, he sits down, and he paints a beautiful painting of this scene of the chasen and kala of ahava. He's done. He takes his canvas. He keeps traveling. Days go by. All of a sudden, he sees this alter yid, this old Jew, wrinkled face, old man, wearing talis and tefillin. He's like speaking with the Kadosh Baruch Hu with such sincerity. He says, wow, I have never in my life seen that kind of emunah before. That's real emunah. He takes out his canvas and he paints this scene of perfect emunah. Now he has his painting of Ahava, his painting of emunah. Weeks have gone by, I got to get home. He starts traveling home. Right before he gets to his town, it's Friday, it's an hour before Shabbos. He gets to the edge of the town, to a little bridge, and he sees these soldiers like hugging each other. Different soldiers, different. He says, what's going on? And they say, well, the war is over, and now there's peace. He says, what war? What do you mean, what war? You must have been away for a while. You know, there's a big war, and now there's peace in the two sides. He says, wow, look at this scene. The soldiers from different sides are all celebrating together. Takes out his canvas. It's almost Shabbos. I have a few minutes left. It's almost dinner. And he paints his perfect scene of Shalom. Now he has the greatest painting of Ahava, greatest painting of Emunah, greatest painting of Shalom. He runs home. It's literally moments to candlelight. He gets to his house. He looks through the window. He pauses for a minute. He sees his wife, who hasn't seen in so long, and she's lighting the Shabbos candles with such sincerity. And he sees his kids on the couch, and he starts listening to this. And his wife starts telling the kids, you have to have emunah. Your father's coming home. He loves you. He promises he's coming home. And she takes out all these letters that he had written to the kids, that he wrote to her when he was courting her, these love letters. And he sees this amazing scene, and he starts crying. He says, you know, I thought I had to travel the world for the perfect ahava, for the perfect emunah, the perfect shalom. Little did I realize I had it in my house the whole time. Let me conclude by saying we spend a lifetime searching for meaning in life, searching for happiness. Baruch Hashem, you're all in Shalvim, amazing yeshiva. You are in the Machovaso Ba'olamo place in this world. This is where the Machovaso Ba'olamo guidance department is, right? At the end of the day, you guys have it all at your fingertips. It's not anywhere else in the world. It's not in all those other things we all search for in life. The Niggun is right here. If I can humbly suggest, and you have amazing Rabbeim and amazing resources to talk to make a plan, if I can humbly suggest, make sure you always remain cognizant, not just today, but 5 years from today, 10 years from today. How am I going to carry this Niggun with me? How am I going to make sure that in 10 years from now, I'm not detached and waiting to hear those knocks? Make sure you bring that with you. And I'll just end with one short idea. I was talking with Zachary the other day, and this is my own idea. Try to push yourself like one or two steps beyond your comfort zone. You know what that was for me? I was never an early morning person. When I'm at home during the week, 5 o'clock in the morning is a real, that's sleeping in. 4:40 in the morning, that alarm's going off. 3 mornings a week, and I'm not speaking about myself, it's just anybody could do this. I'm not, nothing special. 3 mornings a week, 5:15 in the morning, chabura. The other two other mornings a week, 5:30 a.m. daf yomi shir. My day to sleep in is like Sunday, we have a 6:20 a.m. chabura. I'm not, I always slept late growing up. I'm not an early morning person by nature. But like, climb outside your nature a little bit. Take one step further. By the way, the 2-3 hours in the morning before your family wakes up, it's like, that's like gold. That's the time where like the birds are chirping, little cup of coffee. That's when you learn. 7 o'clock comes, already done a shir, already done a chavrusa, already done davening. Like my day, look what I've accomplished in my day already. So whatever it is in your teva, in your life, try to push yourself for the positive, right? Go one step outside your limit. Go two steps outside your limit and carry that with you when you leave yeshiva. Thank you very much. Sorry you're late for dinner.